Welcome this afternoon. My name is John Magnuson, and I've had a chance to meet several of you in the course of the last day or so, and look forward to ongoing conversations. This is the first session of Dreams, Language of the Soul, and we will be meeting, as has been the pattern with my colleagues, over the next 4 days. Barry Lopez. Any of you familiar with Barry Lopez? He's a naturalist out of Notre Dame and one of the Northwest's finest writers, in my opinion. He lives outside Eugene, Oregon, and a couple of years ago published a book called Arctic Dreams, which is the story of his experiences in Alaska and in Canada, up near the Arctic Circle. One of the fascinating chapters of that particular study is called A Country of the Mind. And in it, Lopez talks about the first cartographers, map makers, who came to the coast, the Alaskan coast in the 19th century. And they, of course, were charting the very beautiful but rugged and desolate coastline of Alaska and British Columbia. Well, they ran into Indian people, and they found out, especially the Eskimo people, the Inuit and the Yupiat, had incredible ability to read maps. I mean, without even having a north or south orientation. If they drew a map, the cartographers, the Eskimo Indian people could immediately identify where it was that they were drawing. But the cartographers also had an extreme amount of frustration with the native people. Because when they sat down with them with an interpreter to go over the map, each of the little inlets, each of the little lagoons and harbors and streams had a story behind it. And Lopez talks about a spiritual geography that lies hidden out of sight, beyond and behind every physical geography. You know, and I think it's been mentioned in the last day, but since we've come to Holden, I saw Tom Witt, my colleague, wandering a bit in the village this afternoon. He spent 3 years here. His father was director here. His sister died in Montana a couple of summers ago, and her ashes are scattered here in the forest. I mean, he carries a tremendous kind of spiritual geography for Holden Village. Edna Hong, Edna shared with us the memories and writing of her first chapter by Railroad Creek. So Holden Village carries a spiritual geography as well as it does a physical one. And I'm going to be very frank here. I think sometimes Holden, at least as I went walking today, works against the spiritual geography because it is so absolutely gorgeous and magnificent and awesome that your eyes are always almost over, there's over sensation all around you. So I'm happy to be here bringing an invitation to you into another kind of geography. Because behind each one of you, and as our bodies grow older, you know, and change their form and shape, is a tremendous spiritual story and a geography. And as a younger man, coming to work with you in the middle of my life, I am humbled because there are people here who have suffered and have seen much more of life than I have seen. I walk my own spiritual journey, but I also very much want to and am planning to honor yours and invite you to share parts and portions of your story as the week goes on. Teddy Roosevelt, you know, they used to say, used to take his Secretary of State out and look at the stars every night when he was in Washington, and he'd turn and say, "George, do you think we're small enough yet?" And then they would go to bed for the night. But I think that's an interesting story, because what at least has been the experience for me, when I enter the world in which I'm inviting you to accompany me now for the next few days, it's awesome. It's kind of scary. And it's a bit overwhelming. It's filled full of light, but it's also filled full of darkness. And those of you who have experienced recurrent nightmares, who have spent time in a psychiatric hospital where you've been up very close to the unconscious, you know what I'm talking about. My wife always teases me. She thinks I'm too confident, and warns me about that. And I've learned from her, and I've been tripped and tricked also by the spiritual world of which I invite you to enter with me now. Well, I guess I would like just a little reading of where the group is at. I need to know if you've been to any kind of dream workshops or classes, or have kept dream journals or anything like that. And just feel free, without saying a great deal about it, I just like to kind of monitor that a little bit. Who's had some experiences intentionally with dream work? Anyone in the room at all? Okay. Could you say something about that, what it was, a class or a journal?
Well,
or?
This was a class taught by Jim Soliday in Oregon.
Okay.
And it was 6 weeks, once a week.
Okay.
We did keep a dream journal for 6 weeks, and then our final was to write out one of the dreams, okay, about 2 pages.
Okay.
And turn it in, and we read John Sanford.
Okay, good. There's some books in the bookstore that I'll be talking about later in the week, and we'll give you some hints about what's been helpful for me. Somebody else?
I took the same course.
Oh, okay.
I failed the first
time. All right, great.
I took it, and his mentor was John Sanford and Morton Kelsey.
Okay,
and
great.
And we got the same answer.
All right. Yes?
I took one from, and I can't remember his name, in Tacoma. He's in Tacoma. He's
mm-hmm.
Minister, and he gave a very good workshop on
good.
Green work, and I've also done green work with a friend.
Okay, good. Thank you. Anyone else? Yes.
Well, I kept a dream journal, but it was for a different reason. My nephew was he took his MD in psychiatric work,
mm-hmm.
and asked Bob and I to keep a dream journal for him to use.
Oh, interesting.
So all we did was kept the journal.
Right. Okay, good. How many of you have ever had conversations with your pastor about dreams? Or have ever had something offered within the congregation on dreams? Yeah, okay. Well, what I'd like to do today is we need to establish some common ground. And because I think that all of us have our own experiences here, some more powerful than others with the dream world. And some of it, if it's shared publicly, quite frankly, would be not honored, but seen as bizarre or quacky or something like that. And when Jesus talks about taking your pearls and not throwing them, you know, out casually, I have made many mistakes, many, many, many mistakes in dealing with dreams by too casually talking about them and not choosing a good time and a good place. Yesterday, a young person came to me and said, "I want to tell you a dream I had last night." I was right in the middle of lunch, and I said, hey, I'll be great to talk, I'd be great to talk to you, but not now and not here. Let's set up a time quietly when we can do that. And I invite you during the week, depending on what happens to you here in terms of your own dream life, and I'm going to invite you very practically to, I'm going to give you some tips how to access that world. For those of you who have difficulty accessing the dream world, I'll guarantee, those of you who think, we have anybody here who thinks they don't dream, be absolutely honest, great. One. Okay, I will guarantee you, I will guarantee, and we can put wagers on this, that by Friday, that you will be able to remember a dream by Friday, your departure.
Would you help us to recall the dreams that we have that just disappear?
Sure. And we'll, first of all, when we establish this common ground, we'll understand why they disappear and why some of us perhaps have more access to what I call the unconscious than others. We'll talk about that as well. Maybe one other preliminary comment before we begin, and that's that I'm really not a salesman, you know, out to convince you that dreams are important and the best way to go in terms of your spiritual life. Dreams are one road into the psyche or into the deepest parts of who you are. And it's a long revered road and held in great esteem by many, especially indigenous peoples and by peoples as their testament was in the scripture. But in our own times, as we will discuss on Thursday, when we talk about the church and dreams, you'll see what happened and how we lost that world. And how now we are living in a virtual renaissance and a recovery of the language of the dream. Kelsey wrote a book, God's Forgotten Language. And it is happening. It's happening right now, especially among Roman Catholics, Episcopalians, and a handful of Lutherans. And there's a reason for that as well. There's a reason for that as well that hopefully by the end of the week you'll understand. Feel free to approach me outside the class sessions. And depending how it goes with us, depending on how it goes, we may schedule an extra session maybe at night for people who want to come to deal with specific dreams and who would be willing to sit around a candle and talk. We're going to do some dream work together here, what I would call live TV. We're going to do it. You're going to see us work a dream. But I'm not going to suggest we do that until you do your homework, which is to build some trust and some common conceptual ground so that when we use language, we mutually understand what we mean by it. That's the plan. I'll make sure that I take care of you physically. We won't be seated more than probably 45 minutes. We'll have a break. And there are bathrooms down the hall, upstairs. Time to get coffee if you want. I guess that's about it. Does that sound like the Holden Village orientation, Andra? Huh? Okay. I especially appreciated comments from my colleagues, Tom and Keith, that I will be picking up on a little bit today going with those a bit. So let's begin. The first thing I want to just talk about a little bit is dream patterns in sleep. sleep and dreaming started to be researched in about 1956 at the University of Chicago with the development of a piece of technology called the EEG. Some of you have had that used on yourself or on relatives, where they take electrodes, attach it to different parts of your head, and then they can measure brain waves. And after the development of the EEG in the 1950s, they were actually able to monitor sleep. Otherwise, before that, they never really could understand or at least even get any information what was going on with people. Well, what they discovered was that there was two basic patterns of sleep. And I realize some of this is fairly elementary for some of you, but I'm going to review it very, very swiftly. One type of sleep was called REM sleep, which stands for, it's REM, rapid eye movement. That's when your eyelids are closed and your eyes move around. You watch this in your pets, your dogs, or your husband or your wife or your children. Their little eyes flicker up and down underneath the eyelids. Well, what they discovered was when they would wake somebody up during REM sleep, the person could recall to a high statistical measurement, like upwards of 90%, they could recall a dream. And it's been, or an image of some sort. So it was established that when people REM sleep, that's what we call dream sleep. There's another kind of sleep that we have when we go to sleep, and that's called non-REM sleep. So it just has an N in front of it. And non-REM sleep is when there is no rapid eye movement and there's no dreaming. In other words, you wake somebody up and they don't recall anything. So basically two patterns. Now, the other thing they found, which is something quite fascinating, is that the percentage of dream sleep, REM sleep, that all of us experience is fairly similar. About 20%, one-fifth of our sleep time is dream time. And the periods that we dream are, they come at intervals. The longest period being, some of you know from your own experience, the longest period of your dream usually comes when? Right before you wake up, right, toward the early morning. Now this is primarily scientific information, doesn't seem very relevant, but now let me intrigue you a bit. What they did was an experiment to do some REM deprivation. In other words, when the person went into REM sleep, they woke them up, so they wouldn't allow the person to dream. They only let the person sleep and get their non-REM sleep, their non-dream sleep. What did they find out? After 4 or 5 days, the person ended up with REM sleep upwards of 80%. Now, what was going on?
Dreams were being suppressed?
Yes, and that somehow the psyche needs to dream. And if it doesn't dream, what happens? You become agitated, but you build up so you dream later. I mean, it builds up. In other words, the dreams are struggling to emerge. Now, there's two ways to cut down REM sleep, besides waking somebody up when they're dreaming. There's two other ways. One is use of sedatives, sleeping pills, or other sedatives. The other is use of alcohol. So those of you who are on sedatives, and I haven't asked my colleague here, we'll talk later, whether she is on any kind of prescription medicine. If you are taking sedatives, your REM sleep is cut down radically. You see what the problem is with insomnia? You need to sleep, right? You go to sleep, you can't go to sleep, so you take sleeping pills. And then you sleep for 14 hours and you get up. Are you rested? No, why? You didn't get your REM sleep, exactly. You slept, but you did not get what you needed in terms of your psychological geography. So my point here, to summarize this, to use some theological language, God, we've been created, God has created us to dream. Somehow that is a part of who we are. Now some of us in the room are aware of your dream life and our dream life more than others, and we'll explain about that. Again, by the end of the week, you'll understand why. For some of you, that's more accessible than others. Okay, any questions about that? Let's just stop there for a minute. That's just research and information about sleep. You might want to know something about infants, children. You know, when I was a parent, I remember looking at the little person, my son, and both my daughters sleeping 16, 18 hours a day. And I was told, well, they need their sleep. They're growing physically. Well, that's certainly true. But guess how else they're growing besides physically?
Mentally.
Yeah, psychically, psychologically. And they've done measurements of kids, infants with REM sleep, 90% children. I had an adult say, well, what are they dreaming about? They can't even talk. Well, think about it. If you came into a new planet and you were touched by 10, 12 people, all kinds of colors, all kinds of sounds, trying to make patterns, trying to make sense, of course your little insides would be working to try to figure out what was going on. Okay, that's basically the preliminary information that has been shared with you to attempt to make a case that dreaming is important, it's part of who we are, and that everybody dreams, by the way. Everyone does. Even those with alcohol and heavy sedative use, the REM sleep is cut back dramatically, but you still dream. It's just that there are reasons you can't access, which we'll talk about. Okay, let's move then on to the next part of the session, which will be a map, essentially. I'm going to give you a map of the psyche. Now, there are different ways, you know, there are many different maps. There's AAA maps, there's topographical maps, there's different maps. I'm only going to give you one. There are other maps available. In any school of psychiatry, there's at least a dozen maps that are available for people who work with psychiatric institutions. I'm going to give you one map that I have found very helpful and that would like to use as a way for us to find some common ground. So that's what we're going to do. Now, I've been using a word. I've been using the word soul. I've been using the word psyche. There's a reason for it. It's a Greek word. It's the root word of many familiar terms that we are aware of, like, for instance, psychology, psychiatry, psychosis, psychiatrist, psycho, psychedelic. Okay, we could go on. Psychiatric hospital, psychotropic medicines. Andra can tell you about psychotropic medicines or drugs. Hallucinogens, other kinds of drugs. This has been translated in our culture. This is a Greek word, but it's been translated in our culture as what?
Mind.
If you go to a psychiatric hospital with an illness, people say you have a mental illness. We talk about mental health. The conventional interpretation or description is for mental, right? That's not what the word means. The word actually means wind. or spirit or soul. But yet our culture is highly biased, and so we have interpreted soul as being what? Mental, mind. God lives here. We get sick here. That's how we talk. Somebody has a mental illness. What if we were to talk about people having a soul sickness? Their soul was sick. Their soul was out of balance. Okay? So I'm going to use the word psyche as a way to access, this is going to be a diagram of the psyche. It comes from a school of thought called analytical psychology. Here it is. Now I'm going to suggest the psyche, your psyche and my psyche, looks like an iceberg. You can only see a little bit of it. And it's up here at the top. And I'm going to give it a name. I'm going to call it the ego. What is the ego? The ego is the self-conscious part of who we are. Nobody is born with an ego. Where do egos come from? By learning, by living, by experiencing, right. Ego, to live in the world of the ego is to live in the world of language, being able to hold a job, being able to establish relationships, being able to make a promise and follow through on it. The ego world is the world in which, it's the world of work. It's the world of competition. It's the world of getting along with other people. That doesn't come naturally to people. It must be built. There's a lot of jokes about egos. People say, gee, they got a big ego or a strong ego. There's such thing as a strong ego, but there's also such thing as a weak ego, and there's such thing as an inflated ego. What do you think about a strong ego? Is that a good thing, or would you say that's a problematic situation to be in if you have a strong ego?
I think it'd be a good one.
Yeah, why would it be good?
Well, you think well of yourself.
Mm-hmm. That self-esteem, if somebody criticizes you, you can take it. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to get blown away for a week. Mm-hmm. When I was an intern in Santa Barbara, who's from Santa Ynez? Is it Owen? Yeah. Owen, when I was in Santa Barbara, you're going to love this story. After church one day, a gal came up to me, and I had a fight with my wife, and I wasn't feeling really good, and she said hi, and I didn't. I don't think I heard her. So she left the church, and she didn't come back for 3 weeks. And I went to visit her. She wouldn't talk to me, but the other pastor went to visit, and she said, well, he snubbed me. You see? What was going on with her? Her ego was so fragile that every behavior was interpreted how? Exactly. Same thing with kids. Kids, the way God has created kids and their ego is so fragile. They're very narcissistic. Kids are selfish little people. That's how God made them. That's how they're survivors. And, you know, children... Those of you who have traveled in either war-torn situations or in periods of places of extreme poverty, kids can survive things that adults can never survive. It's because they have selective perception. They only take into their world what they can handle. It's a great survival mechanism when you're a kid. One problem, it doesn't work when you grow up. It's like there's another task when you grow up. Let me give you an example. Divorce. A child's parents go through separation divorce. Parents take the children aside. They say, Johnny, Mommy and Daddy love each other, but we're going to be apart. Is that okay? And we love you. Child says, okay, mommy, okay, daddy. What is the child feeling?
Their fault.
It's their fault. Now, that's not rational, is it? No, it's not rational. Why are they thinking it's their fault? Why?
Nobody else to blame it on?
They are self-centered. They are responsible for everything. Those of you who have children or grandchildren whose parent has died, same thing. They feel guilty for the parent's death. And you can talk to them till your head falls off. And it ain't going to make any difference. Because it's not a rational problem. Are you following me? It's they've got to grow up and realize they're not the center of the universe. And a lot of people never make it. They never grow up. They're always the center, and they've always been the center. And so, as a result, they live with that kind of a burden for them and on them. Usually in my work, I'm a university campus pastor, a lot of this stuff hits the road when they hit about 22, 23. They come into me. And they have guilt. And it's all related to things that happened to their family when they were younger that they owned. And they have to sort it out. And it's a religious problem, as well as oftentimes a psychological problem. Now, we talked about weak egos and strong egos. What about inflated egos?
Well, they're not very good.
I'm sorry?
They're not very good.
They're not very good. Thank you, Harriet. Give me some examples of inflated egos.
People that think they're pretty important.
You bet. There's some professions that are very dangerous, that lure and build inflated egos. What are they?
Politics.
Politics, absolutely. What's
baseball
another one?
Players. Baseball,
professional athletes. What else?
Actors.
Judges.
Judges.
Doctors.
Clergy. Clergy have tremendous problems with this. And they struggle with it, and they're oftentimes, sooner or later, it doesn't work anymore for whatever reason. Now, I think the most tragic examples of inflated egos are the great movie stars, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, some of the great singers and things that are elevated, you know, that always need the crowd. In other words, their identity is only found in their ego. And if that's criticized or they lose their attention, they're devastated. And they oftentimes commit suicide. Anybody who works in a drug rehabilitation center, have any of you worked in a treatment center? There's a joke about the toughest people to crack in treatment centers. Lawyers, doctors, pastors, clergy. Toughest to crack. It's because of the danger of that particular profession with so much public attention, so much ego stuff going on, because they're the center of things. Well, that's the ego. What's down here?
Wibbly wobbly mass.
Yeah, wibbly wobbly mass. Harriet here is. Have you read about this stuff, or are you just using your common sense? This is good. That's exactly what it is. It's called the unconscious. And Edna last night talked about the child. If you want to see the unconscious, there are three good places to go to see it. If you really want to see it, go to a nursery school and ask all the adults to leave for about a day. Leave some food in the middle of the floor and come back in 24 hours. See what you find. That's what the unconscious is. Another example of the unconscious is a psychiatric ward. I once worked in a psychiatric ward in Minnesota in which I had a great conversation with an 18-year-old guy, and we were talking about baseball. Great conversation. I got up, I went to the nurse, I said, hey, there's nothing wrong with this guy. There's no reason he should be here. And I walked to the door and a billiard ball came past my head through the window, right through the window, through a billiard ball, right through the window. In other words, in the unconscious, the good stuff sits right alongside the bad stuff. And it's just all right there. And you don't know which one's gonna come out. So, a nursery school without the adult supervision, a psychiatric hospital is another place you can see the unconscious. And the third, the world of dreams. Because that's where dreams come from the world of the unconscious. And that's why those of you who have ever had rough nightmares, it's pretty scary. It's pretty hard. In fact, once I heard a person who was being discharged from a psychiatric ward saying, you know what it's like to have a psychiatric illness? It's like having a bad dream that you cannot wake up from. That's what it's like. So one of the first things that those of you who have had nervous breakdowns or who will have nervous breakdowns, and some of you will before your life is over probably, the first thing that physicians or medical people will do is to try to what? Stabilize the ego. This is the gate. So you stabilize it, and you usually give a sedative, which will stabilize mood swings and things, and stabilize the ego. Safe and get a person in a safe environment. Make sure there is an order, a ritual, so people feel safe. Okay? The unconscious. Now, let me say something about the unconscious. The person who kind of introduced that world, then we're going to take a break in 5 minutes here. The person who introduced the unconscious into what I would call modern thinking, artists and poets have always known it's there, and good priests and clergy have known that it's there, but the person in our own time, in this century, was Sigmund Freud. And although there's a lot of jokes about Freud, he did a tremendous service by helping people rediscover this world of the unconscious. Freud lived from 1856 to 1939. Now, he developed some ideas about this that were fairly pessimistic, but you need to know them because a lot of dream books that you buy are Freudian in nature. And it makes a difference in how you see the world of the unconscious. He said that basically in here, there were like all mixed up and basically two kind of drives that all of us have inside of us. One he called Eros, which was the drive toward life. And if you want to see this, look at a little four-year-old. Any of your grandkids, you go over and watch them sit up on the floor when they're playing with their blocks. You ever watch their little spines? They kind of just, and you don't have to teach a kid to walk. No, nobody teaches a kid how to walk, no way. I mean, you know, within a matter of months you're trying to keep the child from running all over the house, you know. I mean, there's a natural force that pulls the child up, that wants to be alive, wants to stand, wants to live. It's that life force. And you see it in little children. You also see what Freud called was, he used a fancy name, another Greek name. These are Greek words. Thanatos, which is the drive toward destruction or death. Now, if you want to see that, go to a playground and watch one set of kids build a beautiful tower of sand. And then a bunch of little guys or gals are going to come along and do what? And there's a great, or go to a movie and watch somebody you know, blow something up on the film, and a great cheer goes up, you know. Because essentially, that is part of who we are inside, Freud suggested, that we're filled full of these conflicting things. Now, he said that as we grow up, we're given a superego. And the superego is what we're taught about what's right and wrong. And so the ego becomes like a gatekeeper, a broker. Are you hearing what I'm saying here? In other words, between these two worlds, which he gave this name called the id, and the superego, there's the ego. And that's kind of like the broker, the balancer. If he had a great story once, he said, the beginning of civilization was when the first caveman, instead of hitting his colleague over the head with a big club, swore. Now, why did he say that? Are you following this? I'm testing you here because I've got to make sure you're with me here. Why would he tell such a story? The beginning of civilization was when the first caveman swore rather than hitting his colleague over the head with it. Yes, it was basically taking this need to hit somebody and do what? Saying, this is not a good thing to do, so what should I do? I think I'll swear. That's why there's a French psychiatrist by the name of René Dubos said the person who can't swear is neurotic. That's right. And those of you who are counselors or ever been in counseling or will go one day, you know that the language of the soul is oftentimes profanity. Now, I'm not talking about the casual stuff that you hear, the kind of what I call vulgar, uncivil language. I'm talking about when you say from the very inside of who you are, shit. You know?
See, that's all right.
All right. You owe me one tonight. Great example. You see what the problem is in a lot of ghettos and poor areas in the United States? What happens is poor people oftentimes who are deprived of adequate language training and education, they get frustrated. What are they going to do? They don't know how to talk it out. So one of the first things, if you're a police officer, you're taught to do when you go into an area is you learn to talk. You learn to talk. You learn to talk it out. Talk it out. In fact, Freud became famous in Europe for what he called the talk, for what he came to call the talking cure. Now there's a lot of jokes about that. You know, you go to a psychiatrist, you pay $100, and you talk for an hour, and the guy never says anything. Well, I don't want to make a critique on psychoanalysis, but I do want to say that the talking cure is something that all of us have been a part of and have participated in, and we know it works. It's that incident when your friend comes over crying and she dumps to you the tremendous pain she's feeling, and your little head, your computer and ego is going, how am I going to help her? You know, I've got this number, I've got this guy I can suggest, maybe I should bring her to church. Your mind's going like this as a computer, right? To figure out how to respond to that kind of depth of pain. And then she stops and you lean to tell her your suggestion, and she looks up and she goes, thank you, Harriet. You don't know what this has meant to me. And you haven't even said anything. It's like somehow there is a doctor within us, and that if that can get out, there's a kind of healing that can take place. Okay, when we come back, we're going to take a break for 10 minutes. When we come back, I'm probably going to talk about the most important thing that I'm going to talk about this week. So come back, at least for this session. We're going to talk about conscience, where conscience comes from. And you might be in for some surprises about that. So come back. Let's take a 10-minute break. Secrets are a fascinating subject. Paul Tournier wrote a wonderful book about secrets. Basically, Tournier was a Swiss psychiatrist, and is it? He's, I believe he's still alive.
Oh, he died. Somebody mentioned.
Oh, that's right. He died about a year ago, didn't he? Yeah, that's right. Just recently. He tells a story about a little girl who comes home from school in Switzerland, and the mother says, "You walk on, you know, the right side of the road when you come home." And she was a very obedient little girl, but and she came home, and the mother said, "Which side of the road did you walk on?" And she said, "The left side." And the mother, you know, got really angry with her. Well, all the time the girl on the right side. Now, why would a girl, a little daughter, tell a lie like that to mom and get mom angry? Look at this. Think about the development of the ego when you're small.
Does she have a need to be punished?
It could be, you know, but Tournier uses it as an example, a need to separate from the parent. And the problem with parents who are too nice, too forgiving, is you can't rebel against anything. There are no boundaries. And so you have to test yourself. You have to separate. That's what secrets are. People who can't hold secrets have no ego boundaries. They have no ego boundaries. And to keep a secret takes a strong ego. It's a very powerful thing. My mom used to read my sister's diary, you know? And and I honor my mother. I will honor her for the next 4 days. She died in 1973. And I will honor her by other stories here. But she, you know, by reading my sister's diaries, violated her, you know. And just like I violate my son when he comes home from school, and I struggle with this as a father. He's 15. I say, "How'd it go, Josh?" He said, "Oh, it went okay, Dad." He said, come on, how'd it go? I want to know. And he is a stage of his life where he's saying, "Hey, I'm not going to tell you."
Yeah.
And I'm dying inside, you know, because he's pushing me away. And he needs to push me away. But it hurts. And those of you who have raised kids, you know it. And, you know, I need help with that and to watch him move away. So I like that story from Tournier, and I think it illustrates the complexity of what it means to grow up. You can have the best parents, and you're not going to tell them. You're not going to tell them what you really feel, because if you did, what?
You'd cease being a person.
You'd be a projection of your mom and dad. Huh? You'd be carrying out mommy's dream, carrying out daddy's dream. And we all face that and live with that. And we try to move geographically away. Sometimes that helps, but a lot of times that doesn't help at all. It's a psychological, spiritual thing. You can move 200 miles away and still be mommy's boy or daddy's little girl. And never, you know, are able to establish a romantic relationship with another man because nobody will match daddy. You've never really been able to break with him. Okay, now I'm going to get into, to me, one of the most fascinating aspects of the unconscious, and that has to do with the contributions of a follower of Freud by the name of Carl Jung, who some of you know about. I know Edmund knows, and many of you have read about Jung. Jung lived from 1871 to 1961. And he, in Freud, he was Freud's favorite son. I mean, the heir apparent for the whole Vienna school and European school of analytical psychology. 1913, they broke. And it was over a very interesting discussion. It was about what's inside the unconscious. Jung, see, believed there was not just this wild kind of thing inside it. There was something else inside there. And he gave it a name. He gave it a name. He called it the self. Now you see the problem we've got right away? If there is another part, it's a center of the psyche that's deep in the unconscious, besides the ego, what's the problem? Conflict. Conflict. You've got your head saying one thing and your gut saying another thing. In other words, when somebody says, follow your conscience, who are you supposed to follow? You've got a voice saying this, and you've got a voice saying this. And you've got your friend saying this. So you've got at least several voices, but the two major voices are that from your ego and that from the deep inside the unconscious. Now Jung said some very interesting things that have some implications for all of us. One is that all our life the self seeks to emerge. All our life. It will seek to emerge. And you can fight it, but it's going to win. It's going to win. But it'll win in strange ways. And it'll destroy, ultimately, it will destroy the ego if it has to get out. A lot of nervous breakdowns come because the ego will not listen to what's down here. And so there is such pressure that the ego cracks. Jung believed we are not only a product of our past, driven by these forces, but we are also pulled into the future by this, what he called the archetype of the self. We are pulled somehow. And one of the images of the dream, in the dream world, of the self is of the child. Of the child. That's why throughout our life and in the religious community, being in touch with the child is so, so important. Now we'll talk more about that in the days ahead, but I want you to see the tension. We've got two consciences here. This is a rough one. Because let's take sexuality. You know, if you're a young man, are you going to wait for your mom and dad to tell you when to kiss your girlfriend? Are they ever going to tell you, it's okay, now it's okay, you're 16, you can go kiss your girlfriend?
I didn't wait.
No. Good for Bob. You know, you're gonna not tell mama. You're not going to tell, you're going to do it. You're going to follow this in here. Now, let's take another example. Let's take an example of a woman I interviewed at Milwaukee Psychiatric Hospital. She grew up on a farm in Wisconsin. A traditional farmer's wife, but who had married a very, very rigid, ego-controlling husband. I think he did. I don't think he had a strong ego. I think he had a very fragile ego.
Wibbly wobbly.
Yeah, but not wibbly. So rigid. It had to protect itself, so he had to control his wife. They raised 7 kids. She came into the psychiatric hospital at age 47. And the reason he brought her in, I did the interview with a psychiatrist. She had been in bed 2 years. At home. Now, we had heard this, and you know, the other daughters had taken care of her, and immediately we asked, well, did she get up to go to the bathroom? Yes. Did she ever leave the house? And the husband said, well, yes. Every 10 days she would leave. And we said, leave for what? And he said, to get her hair fixed. Well, we inquired more. Here's his story. He said, I came home from doing the chores in the farm. I walked, she was doing laundry down the basement. She turned around and said to me, I'm not going to do this anymore. Went upstairs and went to bed. Okay? You hear what I'm saying here? A part of her denied, a part of her real self given away to a man in this case, who never probably really, from my interview with him anyway, really cared for her very much, had certain prescriptions about what a woman should do, and, you know, it caught up to her. It caught up to her. And she needed to be cared for. So she got sick. Another great example of this, and all of you have seen this, how many widows and widowers do we have here? Okay, 1, 2. All right. Now I'm going to try something a little dangerous on you, but you hit me if I'm not on track. One of the most fascinating things I've seen working with widows and widowers is that most of us live unconsciously in a relationship with another person, and we give away part of ourselves to that relationship. When that person dies, all of a sudden, guess what comes up? This can come up. And I've seen incredible, it's like a new birth. It's like people essentially being born again. Now, I can't say that that's your experience. You may still be grieving. The death may be still very close to you. And I'm not saying that you'll ever leave those years behind completely. But I do want to say that my experience, and there may be, I see a couple of nodding heads, people who have experienced what I'm talking about. Is that, can anybody identify?
It's been a long time for me, so okay. I was probably, my husband was disabled for so long that I probably had myself, wasn't completely, some other person.
You hadn't given away.
I realized that this is going to happen eventually.
Okay, all right, so you prepared.
Yeah.
Yes.
I had to change completely in order to survive. It's been 15 years for me, but I had to change. I really did. I became, and my kids and anyone that knew me will say, I became an entirely different person in order to survive.
Yes.
And I never felt that I was submissive to him. I mean,
right.
I felt we had a good marriage.
Right,
was not a helpless type.
Right. I don't necessarily mean, when the ego is built, however, around somebody or something else, it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be submissive. Even if it's healthy, it's going to change. And what a lot of people don't remember or don't acknowledge is that there is, as Norman Cousins says, a doctor within us. There is a God within that will pull up from within us a part of ourselves we have not known. Full of wonder and amazement. And that's part of the work of the dream world, to help us remember that, to guide us in this work, to sometimes scare the ego. If you got nightmares, folks, I say, God bless you. Are you going to get them pop me in the nose? But I'm just quoting the Talmud here, who says that every dream, no matter how scary, is a gift, a letter from a friend. And there's something going on, usually in your ego, that needs to be dealt with if you've got recurrent nightmares. Yes?
One of the first things you have to do, though, is a reverse of what you said before. You have to push your children away when you all of a sudden become a widow.
Good. Good. Let me say something about the tasks of the ego. The problem with dealing with dreams with young people, it's different than dealing with dreams with older people. They have different tasks. What is the job of a child or an adolescent? Here. For the ego. What's the job that they are called to do developmentally, would you say? Just use your common sense here. Right. Right. I had one of the greatest conflicts I had with my wife was over my daughter, who will be here next couple weeks. She's 10 now. We had guests over. And they brought their children, and I wanted Samantha to share her toys. She was three. And I said, Samantha, share your toys. Samantha said, no way. I said, Samantha, I took her aside. I said, listen, these are my friends. These poor little children, they need some toys. Be a Christian, you know, do this, all right? She wouldn't do it. And I started to get angry, intense. And my wife came up, she said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm just trying to help my daughter learn how to share. She said, you come here. Took me in the kitchen and said, listen, a little child needs, before they learn how to share, needs to get a sense of their own space and property. That's one of the most important things you can give a child. She's not ready to do that yet. And I said, what am I supposed to do? She said, you've got the problem of being embarrassed, Magnuson. It's not your daughter's problem. She said, use your head. Think up, use your ego. Let's think something up creatively. So I came back and said, Samantha, how about this? You got any other toys that look kind of like this one? Samantha said, yeah, I got one. Okay? So in other words, the task in the dream world and the task in the spiritual world is different for us at different times of our life. Now, when we reach autumn of our lives, the spiritual challenges get the toughest of your life, of your life. So the biggest dragons are waiting for you at the end. That's what happens. And you all know what they are. You all carry them here. You have to start to relinquish the ego. You spend all your life building up your ego. Now you got to give it away. And you know what happens if you don't? You're going to bring down the kingdom like King Lear, who couldn't give away his power. Brought down the kingdom. Hanging on to possessions. Hanging on to the family farm. Huh? Isolated now. Draining what resources you have away. But the real problem, the real struggle, is spiritually giving up your spouse, those of you who are carrying relationships of years. Giving that back to God. Relinquishing that. And finally, the final battle. And many of you are there. I mean, I've already started to fight that one. The final battle, health. When your knees go, you can't climb the mountain anymore. You know, that is a tremendous challenge to the ego, because the ego wants control and has spent all its time learning control. Ken Larson, one of my colleagues, pastor, retired. He sent me some photographs a year ago of my folks, who are both no longer living. And they've been dead now 20 years. My mother, 10 or so. My father, about 20. Sent me these beautiful photographs. He said, John, Louise and I are going through our things. You know, we spend all our life collecting things. And we're spending some good times now giving things away. I want you to have these. Real nice for me. I honor him. Spiritually wise person, knowing this particular challenge of the ego. The self and the ego, the tension, that's what I want to stress to you. Because the dream world, as we get into it tomorrow, you'll see how the dream works and how it tries to bring balance to these two. If you are elected to be bishop in the new church, you might have a dream that you're on a mountain and going to fall off. What's that about?
You might fail.
Could be. Although the spiritual world really doesn't care what you do outwardly. It has a different agenda. What's the danger of being a bishop? Inflated ego. Right. Up too high. Up too high. Up too high. Okay. Attention. Questions on this? I talked about the two consciences. I got a couple of great stories, but I don't want to share them unless if there's some live stuff here we want to deal with. I want you to be able to kind of get a feeling for this. The ego, the unconscious, the self, which is the inner archetype, the superego.
You were telling about this as we get in our mature age that we're in now.
Yeah.
Somebody was telling me he was down in Arizona with the snowbirds, and I guess it was Sun City or one of those places. He said, I just don't want to go there anymore. He said, all these retired executives come down there, they all want to be first, and they all want to be treated like kings.
Mm.
And it's a real battle
interesting.
As to who's going to get the
interesting.
Gained position. You know, here they've lost it, but they haven't given it up yet.
Interesting. Yeah.
Question,
sure.
For which I don't know if you have an answer, but in my head now, ego is our spirit is built.
That's what the world gives us and we develop.
How about the self? You know, is that influenced? I'm thinking about the boy who the mother was trying to get enough to kiss his girl at 16.
Right.
But now, how is that self influenced? Is it influenced by what mother said ever?
The self is... let me say something about the self. There's a wonderful story in Norman Cousins' little volume on humor and healing where he talks about going to see Schweitzer in Africa. And Schweitzer has along the beds all these, along his patients, all these medicine doctors and witch doctors from the tribes. And Cousins can't figure it out, you know. So he says to Schweitzer, What do you got these superstitious guys around here for? These people are sick. And Schweitzer said, come here. So they go for a walk, and Schweitzer says to him, hey, it's simply they know something that any good doctor knows, and any good pastor knows, that there's a doctor with you. And through ritual and singing and bells, and dreams and other things, there's ways to honor that, and there's healing in that. I guess what I want to say to you about that is the self, you see the self in little children, again, going back to Edna's reading last night, you see it in little children, and you see it if you grow with wisdom at the end of your life, you see it in older people, in elders, you see it too. It shines. You can feel it in a person. And as the ego slowly slips away, this shines more, and then you've got what we call real wisdom that emerges. The self is never really fully actualized. But in children who are dying, I'll tell you a story. The last time we're together about... a doctor friend of mine who told me a story in Oregon of one of his patients, a 10-year-old kid, who was 100 years old when he died, inside. And you'll hear the story of how that inner self came out and ministered to his own parents. In fact, I did my clinical training, one of my parts of my education in Chicago at Children's Memorial Hospital, Lincoln Park. And it was a funny thing on the cancer ward. As soon as the parents would come, all the children would get sad. And then when they leave, I'd start talking again. And once we went and asked the children about it, and they said, well, they expect us to be. Now, I'm not saying all children feel that way, but the kids who had the most advanced cases of the terminal illness had worked through a lot of this, and they were far ahead of their parents about what was going to come. There are windows into the unconscious. There are windows. And I just want to name a couple so you know. One is music. Before my daughter could talk, what did you do to her, your granddaughter? You hummed. Why do religious people sing all the time? You understand? It's a language of the soul. That's why, before I said one word here, I sang. to honor the world in which we were going to enter. And Christian people need to sing, because it's a kind of language of the heart. Another way in is dance. Old Swedish Lutherans used to outlaw this in their church basements, and now it's coming back, you know. Another one is art. What are the first two things we cut in our schools when we got low? Any former school teachers? What we're doing to our kids is we're taking them spiritually and strangling them. And our churches should be hard advocates in our schools for music and art programs. We should just be out there just fighting as hard as fighting for Nicaragua or whatever other social issues you're into. Art, music, dance, ritual, prayer, but a lot of prayer that we do is a prayer from the ego. So, yeah, that's how we're taught. And when I was listening to, one of the nice things about listening, like listening to Edna's writing last night, you receive, you know, it's like, that's a kind of prayer. You know, and listening to your dreams, it's like you listen. We're taught in our churches to talk with our ego. So prayer needs some, a lot of us don't know very much about this, and dreams are a nice way to learn how to listen. Lastly, I'm going to just name ritual can work. If it's done well, ritual can work. I've seen people every Sunday when I lead services, and every clergy person will stand by my side as we see people tear up in the congregation. And you know, if you've got an inflated ego, you think it's something that you said in your sermon, right? It has nothing to do with your sermon. The person's looking or feeling the creed or looking at the cross or singing the liturgy or a hymn or something. That's what hits. Good ritual is a healing thing. And lastly, drugs. Drugs are a way into the unconscious. Drugs are taking an elevator shaft straight down. Nancy Reagan says, say no. Where is she talking from? The ego. Get control of yourself. Say no. That's baloney, people. That is baloney. It ain't going to work. What you see in the drug culture and the abuse is a tremendous spiritual hunger that's all distorted and warped. It's people not standing to live here anymore. They cannot stand to live in a society where they do not have a chance. So why not choose another reality? Let's go down. And if those of you who have worked with drug culture people, you know that there are good trips and bad trips. But once you get hooked, it's not just simply a physiological addiction, it's a psychological addiction.
Is part of our drug problem the fact that many of these other...
Absolutely, I'm convinced of it. I am convinced of it, that we in our culture are an egocentric culture. We are a tremendously materialistic culture. We have forgotten this world. We have denied this world. We measure our churches. The first issue of the ELCA Lutheran magazine listed the top 10 biggest churches in the ELCA. You know? That about sums it up right there. About six issues later, they printed the 10 smallest. And you know why they did, too. Because there's enough people with their, you know, their common sense out there that probably, you know, threatened to blow the place up. That kind of mentality, institutional mentality, which is bigger and better. More money is better. More places you travel to is better. See? That's all, and it is better if you live up here. If that's what the world is, building kingdoms. If that's what the world is, then you better go for it. And that's where the culture is. So I'm convinced that it's a spiritual problem, and you know, I don't have any program or platform, but I'm saying that we have to kind of start where God has placed us, whether it be dealing with your own children or your grandchildren or yourself and how you deal with your own life. So
Is that? Mm-hmm. Do you feel then that more emphasis on such things as music, dance, art, and so on might be part of the solution to the problem?
There has to be a recovery, a balance of the spiritual. And, you know, some of the comments that were made this morning about the earth's part of that. You know, learning to live with the earth, the seasons of this, just looking at the seasons of nature. If you lived in France, everybody gets 6 weeks off in the summer. I mean, everybody. They think we're crazy over here. I've got young people coming to me who are 22 years old, making $30,000 a year, graduating from college. I say, how many weeks off you got a year? They say, two. I say, well, why don't you trade off? They're just getting married, right? I say, why don't you trade off a little money for a little time? They say, well, why would I do that? That's what they tell me. Completely seduced into measuring the value of their life by what they can make or achieve or acquire. Quality gone. Quantity reigns. Length of life becomes the most important thing, not quality. Length of life. These are some of the dangers and problems. I want to say the royal road, Freud called it the royal road, via Rosa called it the royal road into the unconscious. And scripture bears witness to that, is the dream. Not the only way, but the royal road. And you'll soon hear in the next days why dreams. These are doorways into this world. Now I'm going to close. We've got about 5 minutes. Let's take one question, then I want to close with one story, and we'll close with a song. Because we want to enter the ritual. We want to enter with ritual, and we'll close with ritual each time. Any question? Let's take our comment. Yeah, Edna.
Have you read Charles Lamb's essay in which he discusses prayer?
And he says, I haven't.
He says, why do we have grace before meat and potatoes? Why don't we have grace before reading a book? Grace before a symphony concert? Nice. Or grace before a mountain or something like that?
Nice. The ego world is a world of language also. And my family now prays before meals with a Buddhist prayer that we've used. Although we've appropriated to our Christian faith, when we take our meal, we take our hands and go like this around our plates. And we eat.
Say that again, please.
We have our plate here. Here's my plate. And we dish our food up. And then all of us together, we take our hands. This is a Buddhist prayer. Around the food like this and simply bow our heads. That's our prayer. It's acknowledging that the food is a gift. You don't always have to talk. See? You always don't have to talk.
That's the ego talk, wanting to talk.
Yes. See why sermons, when you hear sermons, right when the pastor said it, you want them to stop. Yeah. And then they keep going. That's the ego. That's the ego going. See, I do the same thing. All right. Yeah. Okay, let me tell you a quick last one about the tension between these two, and we'll sing. You see why it's so hard to get into the area of sexual ethics? You see why it's so hard to tell somebody what's right and what's wrong, whether to get a divorce or not get a divorce, or get an abortion or not an abortion? I mean, there are certain principles that we can stand by. That it would be best to keep a marriage together. It would be best not to have to deal with abortion. But when it finally comes down to it, finally, you know, it's a very complex world we live in. And let me show you how complex this is. by a brief story, and then we'll sing. I had about 7 years ago, I'm looking at Ann because she's on the Lutheran Campus Ministry Council in Oregon. And one day, a couple came in to see me, a senior from the university who was bringing his fiancée to get married. And they had a problem. He was raised Missouri Synod, which is straight, very conservative, good, strong, follow the rules. He was Mr. Clean. He looked Mr. Clean. He was every mother's dream, you know. 25 years old, successful engineer. He brought this beautiful young woman with him who had never been in a church, essentially, and who he was slowly bringing to church, and she was getting kind of acquainted. But in Oregon, there are a lot of people who are in church, and she was one of those people. Well, right before the end of the engagement period, she disclosed to him that she had had a couple of different lovers before him. In other words, sexual experiences. Now, he was raised to have very strong feelings about saving himself for the woman he was to marry. Okay? I mean, he followed the guidelines. He lived the fairy book story. He did it. And he saved himself. And he said, I cannot stand this. I love her, Madeline. I love her, this woman. But I can't stand what I'm feeling because all my life I have waited for this woman to have saved herself for me, and I have saved herself for her, and I can't deal with it. I can't deal with this. That's why they came to talk to me. Tremendous pain. And I looked at Madeline, the young woman, and I said, Madeline, what does it feel like when he talks about you like this? When you describe, what are you feeling like as he's talking about the situation? She said to me, I feel like I'm dirty. I feel like I'm secondhand. I looked at her and I said, are you? She looked at me and she said, you know, if I had to live my life over, I'd do some things different. But no, I'm not dirty. And I'm not secondhand. And he had what we call in clinical language a relaxation response. He went just like this. He was just on his chair. He went just like this. What happened here? You understand what she was able to do? She went down and found that part of her that God made and said, and she's not a Christian, you know? And so she gave it back to him, and he understood finally what his baptism meant. Now, she was baptized 3 weeks later. They got two little kids, live in Portland. But every case of incest and rape, that's what the therapy seeks to do, is to go down through the ego to find the virgin, because the virgin in you is God's, and it doesn't matter what's happened to you physically at all. If you can touch that, that's when the healing begins. But you gotta find it, and it's buried. It's buried for most of us. We live surrounded with ego messages, you know. And so I just want to end with that story as an example of how God used, quote, a pagan or a heathen to teach a pastor and, you know, a faithful Lutheran what his baptism meant. So, let's close with the way we opened. We'll sing together. And for those of you who wish to continue, see you tomorrow morning. Spirit of the living God, fall.